Hello, I'm Kathleen Dunn, and you are listening to the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 24th of May. President Obama is in Europe, and it has been called perhaps his most significant foreign journey this year, enabling him to solidify ties with his closest allies on a range of security and economic issues, while also scoring points with the voters back home, particularly the Irish and the Polish voters. He certainly seemed to enjoy his pint of Guinness. He'll be talking about a number of issues with a number of leaders: the war in Afghanistan, the stalled rebellion in Libya, the crackdown in Syria, and all of the changes that have come since the beginning of the Arab Spring, and how it is that countries in Europe may be able to help those countries part of the Arab Spring. The world economy is recovering at different paces in different regions, and we'll be talking about that recovery and what seems to be stalling it, and also some of the support that financially rich countries may be able to give to those who are in a democratic transition. So we have a lot on the table this hour of the program. Our guest is Professor James Goldgeier, Professor of Political Science and International Affairs at the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University, author of America Between the Wars, from 11/9 to 9/11. And it was just announced yesterday that he is now going to be going to American University, or he will take over at, well, let's see, where is this? American University has named him to be the dean of the School of International Service. So that appointment will start in August. We'll be welcoming phone calls, as we always do. Our phone number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Or you can send an email, and that's talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. Professor James Goldgeier, thank you very much for being with us.
Oh, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, congratulations on the new assignment.
Thank you very much.
Yeah. So the president's trip started really in Ireland, and he knows how to enjoy a pint of Guinness, huh?
Well, he looked like he was having a great time.
I know.
And it was a great way to start the trip, so good for him.
Why is he including Ireland and Poland on this trip?
Well, you know, it's always good in an election year to go to Ireland and remind the voters of your Irish roots. So,
right.
I think, and they were certainly excited to have him. So I think that was a very nice way to start the trip. And he's got a lot of business to do then in London and then in France with the G8 meetings. And the trip to Poland, he was supposed to go to Poland last year and had to cancel because of the volcanic eruption. And so I think it was important for him to be able to reschedule that visit. And he'll be having a dinner with Central and Eastern European heads of state and government, and I think it's a great opportunity for him to solidify the relationship with those countries.
How deep is, let's start with Libya, how involved is NATO in the air campaign, and how deep is the concern that this military campaign, which has been going on for a couple months now, seems to be dragging?
Well, I think NATO officials are feeling good about the way in which things seem to be developing and the further isolation of Muammar Gaddafi and the ability of the alliance to help the rebels gain a little more space. But there's no question that this conflict has dragged on now for a couple of months, and we're seeing NATO stepping up its military activity, especially in targets. What they're describing as command and control targets in Tripoli. I think they really want to try to put Gaddafi on the run right now and want to see if they can really put enough pressure on that they can change the situation once and for all in favor of the rebels. The last thing they want to do is have this thing drag on for months more.
Mm-hmm. Will the leaders of these countries be expressing concern to President Obama that the strategy needs to change in any significant way?
Well, I think the strategy has been changing in recent days. Again, we've seen NATO step up the activity, especially directed against the core targets of Gaddafi. So I think that they'll certainly be discussing how they think the conflict is going, how they think the operation is going, and what they can do really to try to isolate and finally remove Gaddafi. They've all spoken about the need for Gaddafi to go, and so it's important for them really to try to figure out how to make that happen.
How significant is the European concern, and what is the president being advised by European allies about the crackdown in Syria?
Well, everyone's concerned about the crackdown in Syria. I think, you know, there had been what now are clearly misplaced hopes that President Assad would be a reformer and would be able to carry out reform in Syria. And now it's very clear that he's not a reformer. And the problem is that the tools at the West's disposal to try to deal with the situation in Syria are very limited. But of course, as you have the alliance acting in Libya in order to protect civilians there, it's just even more glaring how little it's possible to do things in Syria. And so I think at this point, there's certainly going to be a lot of discussion about what kinds of options they might have, but we won't see the kind of military activity in Syria that we've seen in Libya, and so it's really not clear how much they can do. We've seen additional sanctions put on, including on Assad himself, but it's a very difficult problem.
For those countries that have toppled autocrats this last year, those countries part of the Arab Spring, are they calling for increased financial support? Is there financial support that people in Europe can agree to give to these countries? And will that be on the table during this European visit?
Well, they'll certainly be discussing what kinds of support that they can give. And, of course, the big question is how best to support Egypt and the effort to build a stable democracy in Egypt, you know, after the removal of President Mubarak, and as we approach the elections in Egypt, what can really be done? President Obama, in his speech last week, talked about debt forgiveness on the part of the United States to try to help the new Egyptian government. But the problem we face in thinking about assistance is, of course, that the United States is very financially constrained right now. And the Europeans have significant issues just within Europe itself, Greece and other countries in Europe that need support. So it's a very difficult time to be providing assistance. But this is such a huge opportunity in Egypt and so important for the broader region, how Egypt turns out. So they will certainly be talking about what they can do. And certainly from President Obama's standpoint, to be able to talk broadly with his colleagues about multilateral assistance, assistance from the Europeans, assistance from Japan, assistance from international organizations. This is not just going to be the United States trying to support Egypt, but this is really has to really be broad-based support across the international community.
Can they do some kind of debt forgiveness?
Well, that's what the United States has announced, and you know, certainly that's one option, but what we've seen in the past is just how important it is to be able to provide support for countries. It's very difficult to go from a system in which you've had autocratic rule to building democracy. And 20 years ago, we were doing this with the Central and Eastern Europeans, and there were lots of resources at our disposal to help the Central and Eastern Europeans. You had the prospect of membership in NATO and the European Union that was so vital in helping those countries reform, and even in those countries, very difficult. It was very difficult and a very long-term process to build democracy and a market economy, and certainly some of the countries in Central and Eastern Europe really struggled, but there was just a whole different level of options available to help those countries, and that's what concerns a lot of people about Egypt, is just where are those. What are the options for really trying to help that country And the people in that country developed their own brand of democracy.
Mm. Certainly, though, the moment is now to help.
The moment is now, yes.
Yeah. And let's talk about the financial straits that many European countries find themselves in and the bailout of some of those countries. Who's doing well? Who's not doing well? Has the bailout helped in any way? Are there some countries that are upset that money has been given by the European Union to help some other countries out?
Well, the tensions are running very high, and that's because you have some of the wealthier countries in the European Union, and particularly Germany, really in a position where they have to provide a significant amount of support to countries that are really struggling, like Greece.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, they've had a series of bailouts already. Greece clearly needs more assistance, and the patience on the part, certainly in the populations in Northern Europe, and again in Germany in particular, patience is running thin with respect to having to bail countries in Southern Europe out. But one of the big problems is that so much of the debt was lending from German and French banks to countries like Greece, and so the ties are very deep, and they really don't have much choice but to try to help these countries work through their problems. But it's certainly extremely significant, and the solutions are limited just because all the countries are in the Eurozone and are using the same currency, so you don't have the option. For example, if Greece had its own currency, they could devalue the currency, and you could, you know, you'd have the options that would be associated with having your own currency. They don't have that choice because they're in the Eurozone, and that's one of the other issues that's raised is what's the threat to the euro itself to have these kinds of splits emerging in Europe.
Why is Germany doing so well?
Well, Germany is doing well largely on the strength of its exports. It is producing products that people want to buy. And so they've been extremely successful in exporting and are, you know, a global leader in exports. And that has really helped ensure that they've had significant economic growth recently.
And if you were to describe the situation economically in Ireland, which was really booming not that long ago, how would you describe it now?
Well, you know, in addition to Greece, you've had problems in Ireland, in Spain, and in Portugal, and even in Italy. And all these countries are different, but they're certainly all struggling to one degree or another. And this is a problem for Europe as a whole.
We're going to welcome phone calls. Here's our phone number. The president is in Europe, and he is talking about a number of issues. We're looking at the Arab Spring and how the moment is now to help those countries who are trying to grow democracy. What is it that the European Union can do about that? What about the financial straits that some European countries find themselves in? The relationship with Russia, we have yet to talk about that. That's another goal of this trip. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org, talk@wpr.org. At least until August of this year, our guest is Professor of Political Science and International Affairs in the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University. In August, he will become Dean of the American University International School of International Service. He is the author of America Between the Wars from 11/9 to 9/11. And he has co-authored and authored a number of other books, including Not Whether But When, The U.S. Decision to Enlarge NATO, Power and Purpose, U.S. Policy Toward Russia After the Cold War. And we will be with you and your calls and comments in just a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls, starting with Tony in Oaklawn. Hi, Tony.
Hi, how are you?
All right.
I don't know if either you or the good professor saw Fareed Zakaria interviewing the four activist students in Egypt this weekend, but if you didn't, you should have. because they basically branded the Obama administration as hypocritical and worthless. They said that the man is all talk and absolutely no action. His hypocrisy has to do with the absolute absence of taking any action against Saudi Arabia because of the oil. And the fact was that Al-Baradei basically implied that by throwing Mubarak so rapidly under the bus, that they've created military rule in Egypt at the present time. There is no elections planned. The military is torturing people. And these four young activists said they're going to have to go back into the streets on the 27th, and that there's going to be a poor uprising by the poor. And Al-Baradei basically said, and this is absolutely hysterical, that at the end of the day, it looks like the Muslim Brotherhood is going to take control of the situation in Egypt. So it just goes to show you what, and by the way, they do not like the word Arab Spring. They said this has nothing to do with seasons. And so the net effect is this theoretical naivete on the part of the American administration has created an utter chaotic situation in Egypt. And I think Americans generally need to be aware of this. That's my comment.
All right, Tony, thanks for the call. Professor.
Well, thanks for the comment. And I didn't see the interview, but certainly there's a significant number of problems throughout the region, and you've highlighted one of the biggest issues, which is that there's not going to be a one-size-fits-all response to the different problems in the different countries. And you mentioned several of the countries, and you know, there's also still the whole issue of Iraq. So when you think about sort of four major countries in the region, Egypt, Syria, Saudi Arabia, Iraq, significant problems facing the administration. I don't think the administration is naive. I think the fact is the problems are very hard. Saudi Arabia, the United States, is dependent on Saudi Arabia. And certainly it may be put in a very difficult position if that regime is struggling to stay in power, because the fact that the United States has had relatively moderate gas prices over the last several decades has been due to the role that the Saudis have played. We talked about Syria earlier and the limited options there. And with respect to Egypt, the question of how things play out with the elections in the fall, who's organized to get the votes to form a government, and there's been concern all along that the most organized groups are the Muslim Brotherhood and then the military that was working previously for Hosni Mubarak, and that it's very difficult for the opposition groups, the more reformist types, to coalesce around figures to organize themselves in order to be able to be successful at the polls. And so, again, I don't think it's naivete. I think it's the problem of how best to support these groups, what outsiders can do, what resources outsiders can bring. And I think also part of the problem is that you now have, because of the situation in Libya, a significant amount of attention is being paid to that country, and I think inevitably that has taken attention away from Egypt, and that's unfortunate because of the importance that Egypt has for the region as a whole.
Mm-hmm. There's just so much going on in so many countries, Pakistan, Libya, Syria, Egypt, the list continues.
Yeah, there's a lot going on, and certainly the administration has struggled. They seem to have been caught off guard by the initial protests, as were people in the region as well. And they've struggled to lay out a framework for how to think about the region. President Obama gave his important speech last week on the Middle East, but even there we didn't really see a strong framework for how to think about the region as a whole and how to think about what American policy would be toward the region as a whole. And Saudi Arabia, for example, wasn't even mentioned in that speech. So the administration certainly has a lot of work to do to try to figure out how it wants to approach the region. And I think it's important that the president is talking about the support for democracy, but there needs to be a lot of action put behind it.
I was reading a piece in The Guardian yesterday. Timothy Garton Ash is the author, and he says this. I'm wondering what your response is. So far, the president's priorities have been security first, development second, democracy and human rights a very poor third. The passions of his youth, civil resistance in the tradition of Martin Luther King, social self-organization, liberation, have hardly been visible in the actions of this president. This is the perfect moment for him to open a new foreign policy chapter infused with a little more of that passion for democracy.
Well, it's been interesting, and it's been interesting from the beginning of this administration, because I think there are a lot of divisions within the administration about how best to support democracy and how high a priority to make it. And I think a lot of that has to do with how the president and his advisors came in succeeding George W. Bush and his administration, and how they thought about what that administration had done. And there was, I think there was a reaction against the way that George W. Bush had put his so-called freedom agenda front and center in his policy, and was seen as imposing democracy because of the way that the Iraq War had been fought and the toppling of Saddam Hussein and a new regime put into place in Iraq. And so there was this sense from the beginning of the Obama administration that, well, we're not going to do that sort of thing. We're not going to be imposing the West on others. And I think that the president has been trying to find the right balance between wanting to be supportive of democracy efforts, but worried that too much of an American presence taints these homegrown efforts in these countries. And I think he's struggled to find the right balance. And I think what's disappointed a lot of people is that the United States seems to be reacting slowly to all these instances. We saw that early in the administration with the reaction to the opposition forces in Iran and the lack of American support for the Green Movement in Iran, and we saw that same slowness this spring across the Arab world, including in Egypt. And I think it reflects this real tension in the president's mind about how best to do this, and tensions within the administration.
Would it be accurate to say that it caught us by surprise?
Well, I think the events certainly did catch us by surprise, but there's still the bigger question of sort of what's the proper role of the United States in these cases. The United States, again, going back to Central and Eastern Europe 20 years ago, the United States played such an important and prominent role in trying to help those countries move forward, and did so in working very closely with European allies. And that support was critical. But there is this sense, this concern that the president has, that if the United States has too much of a presence, then groups, reformist groups, get tainted and viewed as tools of the West. And I think that they really haven't figured out how best to provide support and how important that is for U.S. foreign policy, given also some of the other competing priorities, and then how to go about it.
We go to Bill in East Washington. Hi, Bill.
Hi.
Hi.
The previous caller sort of touched on two pet peeves of mine. One, it's clear that he doesn't really like Obama, and he wants to spin whatever happens in the Arab world or anywhere else in any way that would make the Obama administration appear in a poor light. I think that's arrogant. I also think it's arrogant that the United States thinks that it has that much power and influence over the Arab world, or that it should have that much power and influence over the Arab world, or that what the president does, regardless of whether you like the president or not like the president, really has that much influence. I mean, if the Arab world wants to become democratic and wants to overthrow its authoritarian regimes, it's going to have to do it on its own. And what we do is just going to muck things up. Take your opinion off the air.
Okay, thanks for the call.
Yeah, I think this is an incredibly important point, and it's an important point more broadly, and that's thinking about the United States' role in the world going forward. Because certainly, for example, in the 1990s, the United States, at the height of its power, really sort of in the driver's seat in international affairs and really feeling like it was running the world. And in the aftermath of Iraq, in the aftermath of the financial crisis, as we see the rise of other powers like China and India and so on, the world really is changing before our eyes. And the United States can still play an important leadership role. But there are lots of things that are going on in the world, and people are doing lots of things, and they aren't really spending a lot of time thinking about the United States. And the caller is correct. You know, what was going on in this region, what's been going on in this region this spring, it's not about us. We do often think that lots of things that are going on in the world are
about
us.
We do.
This wasn't the case. This was about these people deciding, for example, in Egypt, that their desire for dignity, their desire for freedom, their desire not to be ruled by an autocrat anymore, they weren't going to take it. And I think it is important for us to understand, and we should applaud the fact that you've got these homegrown movements in which people are saying, we just can't take it anymore, we don't want to live under these kinds of regimes anymore. But I do think that as a global power and as a country that has supported democracy throughout its history, I think that it's important for us to think about the ways that we can provide support.
Rick in Sheboygan. Hi.
Hi there.
Hi.
I believe within the last week there was an announcement made that the U.S. has forgiven $800 billion worth of debt that was owed to us by Egypt. And if that is an advantage for us to have done that, I'd like to know what the guest thinks the advantage would be for us to have given back, done that. Thanks.
Okay, thank you.
Well, so the president announced in his speech last week that the United States was going to forgive $1 billion worth of Egyptian debt. There's still, the country still has a lot of debt even after that debt forgiveness. And I think the reason is that the president was looking for, you know, some way to try to support the new government that's emerging in Egypt. And again, in an era in which the United States doesn't have a lot of financial resources to be throwing money around in the world, being able to forgive debt was one way of trying to provide that assistance. Now, we've already seen a lot of controversy with respect to that announcement out of concern about who is going to be running Egypt in the future. And certainly if the Muslim Brotherhood does take power in Egypt, there will be increasing calls from Capitol Hill that the United States is not going to be engaged in a policy such as the one the president announced last week with the Muslim Brotherhood in charge of Egypt.
And thanks to the call. We have lines open now if you'd like to join our conversation. We're talking about the president's trip to Europe and all that encompasses, and it's a lot that's on the table. Our guest is Professor James Goldgeier, professor of political science and international affairs in the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University, author of, among many other books, America Between the Wars from 1109 to 9/11. He is becoming the new dean of the School of International Service at American University come this August. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655 is our number, and the email address, if you'd like to use that, is talk@wpr.org. Talk@wpr.org. we don't need to spend a lot of time on this, but I'm wondering if there will be a lot of gossip in the corners about the head of the IMF, the former chief arrested being arrested on attempted rape charges. It certainly was a fairly dramatic story. Will people be commenting on that? Is there unfinished business in that regard?
Well, the biggest unfinished business is who's going to take over the IMF next.
Mm-hmm.
And this really gets back to one of the previous questions about the changing nature of the world. And historically, from the moment that the IMF and the World Bank were founded after the Second World War, pattern has always been that there's a European at the head of the International Monetary Fund and there's an American at the head of the World Bank. And a lot of countries around the world are saying, well, why should that pattern continue? This isn't the 1940s anymore. This is 2011. And why shouldn't there be an opportunity for somebody from India or Brazil or Turkey to become head of the International Monetary Fund? And this is really emerging as a huge issue in Europe. I'm sure they'll be talking about this because the Europeans are saying, look, we're in a crisis right now. The next head of the IMF has to understand that crisis, has to be able to work with us in this crisis. We have to continue to have a European as head of the International Monetary Fund. And sure, you others can maybe be the next head of the International Monetary Fund, but not right now. And that's just not cutting it with a lot of other countries around the world who are saying, look, we should have an open, transparent process. It should be done on the merits, and we need to go about this differently. You can't just say, okay, a European's going to be the head of the IMF. So I think this is really a very important issue and could be the cause of some tension between the United States and the Europeans, because I think that the United States should really be looking at ways to think about how to make the heads of these agencies selected by a more transparent and merit-based process. And it shouldn't just be that, yes, a European just automatically gets to be head of the IMF, or, you know, an American just automatically gets to be head of the World Bank. These are international organizations, and I think we are going to need new processes for these organizations going forward.
Is there any concern, particularly among the French, about the way that Dominique Strauss-Kahn was arrested, put in jail, et cetera? Are they okay with that?
Well, there has been a lot of concern expressed in France, and I think seeing the someone who was very likely to be elected the next president of France. I mean, it's not just that he was head of the International Monetary Fund, but many people believed he would be the next president of France.
Isn't
there
that
is
something?
In handcuffs,
really?
In New York.
Yeah.
And, but I think that as the story unfolded and the allegations against him became more clear, I think that you're seeing more embarrassment than anything else.
Isn't it something, when you said that, it just gives you pause. He, in all likelihood, could have been the next president of France. And if these allegations indeed are true, he has just fallen, completely fallen.
He has completely fallen. And, you know, it's a terrible story, and so are the other stories that are coming out. And I think the other thing that we're seeing in France is you're seeing journalists questioning how they've approached their officials previously. You know, there's been a tradition that you don't discuss the private lives of these individuals, very different from the way we discuss them all the time in the United States. And, you know, I think some people in the United States feel like, gee, you know, why are we digging into the private lives of people? But then you see the what happens when you don't, because people have, there have been these allegations against Strauss-Kahn through the years, and people have kept quiet about it. And, you know, you finally had this, if the allegations are true, this terrible incident in New York. And and now people are saying that, you know, people need to be writing about these things more than they have in the past.
Mm-hmm. Scott in Green Bay is our next caller. Hi, Scott.
Hi there, Kathleen. Actually, it's lacrosse, but
lacrosse. Hi, Scott in lacrosse.
Hi, there is a Scott from Green Bay, but I'm not.
I know
Scott. Anyhow, my question has to do with the former Soviet Union, Russia, and the relationship with NATO and the obvious threat that they've always felt from NATO. And my understanding was that when NATO was originally formed, one of the real rationales for getting Germany in right from the get-go was to, as much as anything, have them in the tent where, you know, you could keep an eye on them. And I've always been curious, after the fall of the Soviet Union, rather than inviting all these surrounding former countries, or maybe in addition, former members of the Warsaw Pact, why didn't NATO ever decide to invite in Russia, get them in the tent?
Well, we could discuss that one all day, but I'll try to be brief. It's a great question, and the relationship has been very difficult from the beginning. And there have been periodic discussions between the United States and Russia regarding whether or not it would make sense for Russia itself to become a member of NATO. We saw that a lot more in the 1990s when Russia seemed to be moving in a democratic direction, and because it's an organization, NATO's an organization, which by treaty is open to any European country that meets the criteria of the alliance and can further the security of the members of the alliance. The issue was the criteria. If Russia became a democratic state and wanted to join NATO, then it's a European country, and by Article 10 of the treaty should be eligible to seek membership. That talk has dissipated as Russia has moved in a more authoritarian direction during this past decade. But it does raise this broader issue of European security and the inability to really bring Russia into Europe after the Cold War. We have this organization, NATO, that covers much of the continent. You then have Russia sitting out there. President Obama will be meeting with Russian President Medvedev on this trip because he's going for meetings of the Group of Eight countries in France this year, this spring, and he and President Medvedev will be meeting this week. I think one of the issues that they'll talk about is the relationship between NATO and Russia, and especially with respect to the issue of NATO's development of a missile defense system, which is directed against Iran or other countries to the south that might be developing ballistic missiles that could be armed with nuclear weapons. And the United States and Russia have, and NATO and Russia have begun a conversation about cooperation on missile defense, again, something that's been talked about on and off over the last 20 years. And I hope that they can really make progress on this discussion to be able to bring Russia into that missile defense cooperation would be a great way of helping to further U.S.-Russian cooperation and NATO-Russian cooperation. And I can't help but, at the end of this mention, back in the late 90s, when the United States was talking about NATO enlargement with the Russians and saying that, trying to convince Boris Yeltsin that, look, the door's open to you guys as well over time. You might be able to join. And Vice President Al Gore was in Russia talking with President Yeltsin about this and repeated this case, and President Yeltsin responded by saying, Russia is very, very big, and NATO is very, very small. And, certainly the size of Russia would give pause to anyone thinking about how to fold it into an organization.
Anything else, Scott?
No, thank you. That's an excellent answer and an excellent program, and I really appreciate this guest, as always. Thanks so much.
Thanks, Scott. Thanks for the call. We'll take more phone calls momentarily. Our number is 800-486-8655. We're talking about the president's trip to Europe, looking at a number of different issues, what's going on in Russia, which was just brought up. We're looking at how the European community is responding to the Arab Spring, what they can do financially, even though some of them are pretty strapped financially, to help some of those countries along. Why the president went to Ireland, we have yet to talk about his major speech, which he will deliver tomorrow in London, and what will be the focus of that. We have also yesterday to talk about peace between the Israelis and the Palestinians, and if the president will be addressing that with any of the leaders that he's meeting with this week. Here's the number again, 800-486-8655. The email is talk@WPR.org. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Our number two of our program today, Mark Kaufman will be joining us. Mark is the science and space reporter for The Washington Post, has been doing this kind of journalism for over 30 years, and is the author of a fascinating book, Scientific Breakthroughs in the Hunt for Life Beyond Earth. It's not only what we're doing with the SETI program and what we're doing in terms of looking at exoplanets, but it's also what's happening in this country going into glaciers, mines way down in the earth, and finding life that can live in the most extreme places, which will help us understand what life is. And of course, we have to ask the question, what is life, when we look at life on other planets. So it's and it's not crazy stuff anymore. There are people who are very, very serious about this and believe that we're going to make enormous breakthroughs in this century, without doubt. All right, we go back to phone calls. 800-486-8655 is our number. Craig in Waukesha is our next caller. Hi, Craig.
Hey there. I've been paying attention to how Netanyahu has been saying that the 67 borders are largely indefensible in response to Obama's speech, but I've been thinking I think that's largely irrelevant because it's estimated that Israel has between 75 and 300 nuclear weapons. Any country that in the Middle East that managed to do any serious damage to Israel or even threaten to drive it in the sea would pretty much be blasted off the face of the earth. So I'm not sure if it's really even relevant that 67 borders are indefensible, because if they managed to wipe out Israel, Israel would pretty much take out the rest of the Middle East with it. And I'll take my comment off there. Thanks. Bye.
Thanks.
Well, I think, the president's speech just really sort of raised a lot of concerns in Israel about whether the United States was changing an approach that it's had now for a number of years. And in fact, President Obama then delivered remarks the following day clarifying what he had said in the speech and seemed to suggest, in fact, that the policy of the United States really hasn't changed as dramatically as might have been believed when he gave the speech last Thursday. But I think, as the president has been saying, sort of trying to figure out the right formula so that you've got two states, both of which feel secure, is the issue. And it's not really about whether or not Israel has sort of nuclear weapons that it can retaliate against other states. I mean, as we've seen, for example, with the Palestinian protesters crossing Israeli borders recently, there are lots of different ways in which Israeli security can be undermined, and that's one of the major issues, as is the question of how the so-called territorial swaps will be negotiated. That is, Israel maintains territory in certain places, sort of what territory it'll be willing to give up to a future Palestinian state. But I think in general what we're seeing is just how it just continues to be difficult to find a way to bring these two sides together.
There's an understatement, huh? Difficult for years and years and years and years.
Yeah, and it's a process that's just really been stuck, and President Obama has tried a number of different ways to try to move it forward, but we saw, for example, recently that his special envoy to the Middle East, George Mitchell, resigned his position, suggesting that that he was frustrated with how things were going. And it just, I think that the thing that makes it so hard is that there was a deal put on the table at the very end of the Clinton administration. And I think people feel like, if there ever is to be a deal, it's basically going to be the framework that was worked out at that time, and just, how hard it is to just get that last push where you can really have two sides that have confidence in the other
where they each would feel secure, and that they would each accept the kinds of territorial changes that, again, were on the table back in 2000.
Thanks, Craig, for the call. Terry in Abbotsford. Hi, Terry.
Good morning. Thank you both. I'm wondering why the fear of the Muslim Brotherhood getting elected. I know their history, but if they get elected and they do a bad job, won't the Egyptians throw them out just like they threw out Hosni Mubarak?
Well, you know, certainly once you come into office, you do have to deliver to the population. And, you know, in a situation in which they're probably not likely to get a majority vote, they're going to have to be in coalition with others if they were to be the leading party. And so there's also some thought that that would moderate their behavior. But anytime you're talking about a fledgling democracy, the fear is always that, you know, in addition, what you don't want, you want one person, one vote. What you don't want is one person, one vote, one time. You want to make sure that a country that has elections then has elections the next time as well. And there's always a concern if you've got a party that is viewed as very radical, that they might not buy into the democratic process over time. So I think that's part of the issue as Egypt tries to establish this democracy.
Thank you, Terry. John in Wallace, Michigan. Hi.
Hi. I'd like the commentator to note United Nations 242 and 338 that stated that the Israel was to withdraw to its 1967 borders, and to note that the United States has not enforced those. I'll take my comments off the air.
Well, this is what's been the subject of negotiations between the two sides, and those borders are used as the basis of negotiations, and that's when you get into this subject that they've both been talking about over the last 10 years or more, and that's the question of how you engage in territorial swaps in order for each side to feel that it's able to get what it wants. But this is a process that's going to take place through negotiation. Now, the other wrinkle in this is the Palestinians may push for a UN General Assembly vote in September that would support their right to exist as a state within those borders, and I think that will be a subject of discussion on the president's trip with his European colleagues, because what the United States does not want to have happen is for Israel to get isolated in that vote, for the United States to be alone in supporting Israel to not have that vote go forward, and would like to see the Europeans on the same side in not having that vote go forward, or at least not supporting that effort at the United Nations General Assembly. So that'll be a subject of discussion in these meetings this week.
The president is meeting with Prime Minister David Cameron. I have read that the president is a little concerned that England may want to scale back some of its commitment to Afghanistan. What do you think?
Well, they do, yes, they absolutely do, and the problem is that the British are constrained financially, and so you know, they're very overextended right now. They've got their commitments in Afghanistan, they've got the new commitments in Libya. They're cutting back on their defense budget. They're cutting their budget in general. You know, they're in the middle of an austerity program under this Cameron government, and they just don't have the resources. And so that's a legitimate concern from the United States. But the British, they don't have the resources. They don't have the resources. And I think this is a more general problem for Europe, is sort of what kind of resources they will be able to devote going forward to defense, and whether they can remain the kind of partners with the United States that they've been historically.
And we have to do this in 45 seconds. Does the U.S. plan to lift its requirement for visas for Polish visitors to the United States, as it said it would do when Poland agreed to give assistance during the Iraq War?
Well, certainly if President Obama makes that announcement in Poland, he'll have a very excited audience in Poland. That's something that they're looking for, and you know, we'll just have to wait and see when he goes on his visit to Poland, what he's prepared to do and what the possibilities are. But it's certainly something that the Poles are looking for.
Mm-hmm. Well, thank you so much. We really covered a lot of territory, didn't we, in the last hour?
Well, it's great to be with you, and great to hear from the callers. Those were all just terrific questions.
Thank you. Thank you very much, and all the best on your new assignment. Professor James Goldgeier, as of August, he is the new dean of the School of International Service at American University. Until then, he remains professor of political science and international affairs in the Elliott School of International Affairs at George Washington University. He's the author of a number of books, including America Between the Wars from 11/9 to 9/11, named a best book of 2008 by Slate and a favorite book of 2008 by the Daily Beast. He's also co-author of Power and Purpose, U.S. Policy Toward Russia After the Cold War. Thanks to Chrissy Pease for producing the hour, and to Chrissy for on-air production as well. And thanks for all of your great calls. More ahead.